final case of the morning is United States against Clements. Mr. Sellers.
Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Joshua Sellers. I'm here this morning on behalf of the defendant appellant, Marvin Clements. I'm also a senior law student licensed to practice under Rule 711. I'd like to make 2 points this morning. The first is that Mr. Clements' case satisfies the good cause requirement of Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure 12E due to the fact that Mr. Clements' trial counsel was given only 8 days between formal appointment and the
Mr.
final
Clements,
deadline.
Mr. Clements, how do we know whether that was whether that porridge was too hot, too cold, or just right? Since the defense lawyer didn't ask for more time, why should we conclude that it was good cause? If he had said, I need more time, and the district judge had said, I'm a real meanie, you don't get any more time, then one might say there was good cause, but he didn't ask. How do we know this is good cause, then?
Well, Your Honor, we don't know, and to be honest, I'm in as good a position as you in terms of speculating about what happened. But what I do know is, based on the record, there was only an 8-day window available. And
let me give you a version of the question that I asked in the last case. If the lawyer had asked for more time and the district judge had said no or had given less time than the lawyer wanted, we would review that for abuse of discretion. But it looks like you're asking us just to bypass that. In other words, it would be very deferential appellate review. It looks like you're asking us to bypass the deferential appellate review and make a de novo decision so that on that view, the defense lawyer is always better off not asking the district court because then he can get a de novo decision on appeal. But that doesn't sound like the right approach, does it?
It doesn't, and I think again, when the record is as clear as it is, where there was an 8-day window, which has been recorded. Now, in your hypothetical, it's possible trial counsel may have had a month, may have had 2 or 3 months. And in situations like that,
as a matter of absolute fact, any time there's only 8 days between the time of being retained or being appointed and the trial, there's error.
Well, it's certainly in trial counsel's interest to file the motions on time, whether it's 8 days
or
longer.
Listen to the question. Is it reversible error by the fact that you have not given sufficient time if you just say 8 days is not enough in any case?
I would not say it's reversible error on its own, Your Honor, but I would encourage the court to move to a plain error review, as is proper under
what
federal
would you
law.
Have to show besides the fact that it was only 8 days?
I think 8 days is sufficient. It's plainly insufficient for trial counsel to comprehensively review.
In any case, 8 days is insufficient. If you had a dollar for every time a prosecutor walked in with 20 minutes preparation on trial and tried the case effectively, you'd be a rich man.
I'm sure that's the case.
One might say 8 days is insufficient to present your case, but this was 8 days to make a motion, that is, to alert the judge that you wanted to make such an argument. And the Speedy Trial Act gives, presumptively, only 70 days from arrest to trial. And the district judge presumably has to parcel out this time. And one perfectly sensible thing to do may be to set 8 days or 10 days to make a motion, and then you have some time to gather and marshal the evidence and present it. I bet you could decide in 8 days or less whether to make a motion to suppress, even though you couldn't marshal all the evidence by then.
Well, I'd like to believe that I'd require more time to comprehensively review everything and also decide which motions are necessary to be filed.
Well, I think maybe what you need to do is consider whether all motions are equal. And because, you know, obviously we don't want a set of rules that will encourage lawyers to flood the courts with frivolous and ill-founded motions just because they only have 8 days and they figure, boy, I better throw it all into the hopper lest I be found to have accidentally failed to comply with 12E or any other similar rule. So the question in some sense in this case is whether this suppression motion, based on what a 10-minute conversation with Mr. Clements would have revealed to you, was something that was questionable enough that more investigation would have been needed than 8 days would afford. I think it in some sense would have to be more, at least from your point of view, it would have to be a more contextual inquiry, else you fall into the trap that Judge Bauer has pointed out, that a lot of lawyers and a lot of public defenders and a lot of other people don't have the luxury of even 3 days, much less eight. But anyway, moving on, let me tell you about the concern I have with the merits of your argument, if we were to reach that. We really have divided Fourth Amendment issues, if you will, and I'm trying to be very broad about that, not into two, but into three categories. If the police were to walk up to a person standing on the street or a car parked, that's not anything. They can do that with on a whim if they want to. And they can say, do you mind if I chat with you for a few minutes? And if the person says, get lost, you know, then maybe we start thinking about Terry and we start thinking about the Fourth Amendment. But in this instance, Mr. Clements's car was parked. The police officers who came up didn't stop him, didn't seize him, didn't do anything. They turned some lights on and walked up. And I have a hard time seeing how the Fourth Amendment is really engaged at all in the process of turning on lights and walking up to a car. And if it isn't, then everything else seems to kind of cascade along. As soon as Officer Boss sees Mr. Clements, there's this knife, and he kind of steps back. Well, that surely must be enough to engage Terry. And then when Mr. Clements gets out, the magazine clunks to the ground, and that, I would think, is at least enough for a further Terry investigation, if not actually. So see what I'm saying? You know, that first encounter, I don't see governed by the Fourth Amendment at all. It's not like they pulled the car over while it was driving down the street or anything.
Well, the officer response was based on a single anonymous call.
Yeah, but so what? Why couldn't they walk up to any car, even without the anonymous call, if it's just parked on the street?
I'd be checking for the safety of the people inside the car.
Had they walked up perhaps with a flashlight, we might be having a different conversation. Well, but they parked the vehicle adjacent to Mr. Clements' vehicle. They activated.
One of the problems that he faces, when a police officer goes to he has to identify himself as a police officer pretty early on, keep from getting shot between the eyes and the ground that somebody says he was suspecting an intruder. So he has to have some sort. The lights are one of the obvious ways to do it, flip it on. So then you walk forward to see if anybody's being assassinated or subject to all sorts of different things in the car. And that happens on a regular basis. That can't involve a Fourth Amendment seizure.
Well, it isn't that the officers had no information, Your Honor. Remember, they had the information that they received from the call. It specified one individual in a vehicle.
He goes to see to a car that's just there, just sitting, somebody in the car. Isn't it appropriate for him to go to see whether everything is okay? There's nothing wrong in the car. There's nobody sick, nobody being assaulted, nothing wrong. And that's what he's doing.
Well, the officers could have observed that perhaps from a reasonable distance. They could have followed standard protocol.
You can't tell from a reasonable distance what's going on inside a car. You have to walk up to look.
Again, Your Honor, walking up to look is quite different than parking the police vehicle adjacent to the
defendant. You're back to my original one. He has to identify himself to say why he got there, why he's there looking, who he is.
Sure, but there are more innocuous ways to announce that you're
an officer. Sure, maybe. You're making it a constitutional requirement that he uses, sneak up behind him and peep through the back window so he doesn't bother anybody.
Well, he could approach from the front with a flashlight again.
Could have. But the question isn't what he could have done. The question is what he did constitutionally inappropriate, Fourth Amendment-wise.
I believe that it was, based on parking the vehicle adjacent, activating the vehicle, the police spotlight, as well as the red and blue police lights.
I'm not asking you to confess here. Go ahead.
As well as the police lights, which certainly suggested to Mr. Clements, as it would any reasonable person, that he was not free to leave the scene, which, again, is, I think, relevant. But specifically in the instance of these anonymous call cases, officers do need some reasonable suspicion, and the leading precedent in the circuit bears that out.
Well, they do as soon as they start engaging the Fourth Amendment. But as I say, if it's just a parked car in the street and the police officer walks up to it, or it's a person standing, you know, on the sidewalk out in front of the Dirksen building and a police officer walks up and says, I'd like to talk to you, I'm not sure they need anything. They whether it's an anonymous call, whether it's a whim, whether it's just a sense that, you know, maybe I better talk to this whatever. These are all subjective things. From an objective point of view, if that initial encounter is just the officer walking up, then it doesn't matter why the officer decided to do it. Now, you're saying there's more in this context with the flashing lights and, you know, the car blocking, and maybe there is. If the car had actually, you know, had like a Star Trek cone dropped over it so that it couldn't move, fine. You know, the car's been seized. But I'm not sure we got there in this case.
See, my time is up. I could just make one final point on it. If what you say is correct, then I think this is a great opportunity for this court to help clarify that, because, again, the leading precedent in the circuit has held otherwise in many other anonymous phone call reasonable suspicion cases.
Thank you,
Mr. Sellers. Mr. Koenig.
Good morning. May it please the court. Jonathan Koenig, and I appear on behalf of the United States. I would like to begin by shedding some light, perhaps, on the good cause argument that my opponent makes in his reply brief for the first time. He says there was an egregiously short window for the filing of pretrial motions. And he comes to that conclusion by dating from the formal appointment of counsel under the CJA to the filing deadline, which is 8 days. But I would like to point out for the record that Mr. Clement's attorney, Ann Bowie, was involved from the very outset of the case. She appeared on behalf of Mr. Clement at the arraignment and was provided with discovery at that time, which was February 24th.
How much time is that?
I believe that's about 3 weeks, Your Honor. We obviously rely on Johnson for the proposition that good cause has to be shown. I don't believe it has been shown in this case. And on the merits, I believe that, as indicated by some of the panel's questions, the Fourth Amendment really is not implicated. Under Burton and some of the other court's recent decisions, there's at least three categories, maybe more of a what the court has
described. They tend to proliferate, I know.
A continuum.
Yes.
And, but rather than try to delineate exactly where this case falls in that continuum, we would rely on Johnson for the proposition that good cause has not been shown. On the competence issue, I think
it wasn't raised in argument.
Okay. Then in that case, I will rely on my brief, unless, of course, the court has any further questions.
Unless you feel that it would not be competent for you to do otherwise.
Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Thank you very much. Mr. Sellers, we'll give you 1 minute for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd just like to draw a distinction. It's in the brief, but again, the government relies solely on United States v. Johnson. I think Johnson presents a slightly different case where trial counsel filed one pretrial suppression motion and then at a later date attempted to modify that motion and kind of through a sleight of hand resubmit it. I think Johnson is a much different scenario than what we have in this case, where, again, no motions were filed at any point. I think Johnson suggests some awareness on the part of trial counsel, and perhaps in a situation like that, this court might be sensitive to.
Mr. Sellers, do you agree with Mr. Koenig about the timing? When did defense counsel first become involved?
He is correct that defense counsel was involved at an earlier point, but my understanding is that often attorneys are involved at earlier stages, but their active involvement, and most importantly, their resources don't come into play.
I'm not sure I understood Mr. Koenig correctly. Was it involved 3 weeks before the 8-day period began, or defense counsel had 3 weeks total?
There was one hearing that occurred 3 weeks prior, which the record suggests.
Three weeks prior to the formal appointment. So defense counsel on that view would have had roughly a month.
On that view, but what the trial counsel's involvement was during that time is very unclear. And again, my understanding is that often attorneys switch around until formal appointment takes place.
One reason why I'm worried about this is that since your opening brief reads as if this were a fully preserved issue, and you didn't raise the 8-day business until the reply brief, you have deprived both the government and this court of the ability to make an intelligent decision about this point. These issues cannot be ignored head-in-sand fashion in an opening brief and then raised for the first time in a reply brief.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. We appreciate your willingness and the clinics to accept the appointment. The case is taken under advisement.